Welcome to the Marriage and Immigration Podcast with immigration attorney Heather Poole, where Heather tackles the tough stuff that can derail a green card application and ability to sponsor your spouse or yourself. Keep in mind, this podcast should not be relied on as legal advice. Always consult an experienced immigration attorney about your specific case. You never know what options may be available to you. And now, your host, immigration attorney, Heather Poole.
Welcome, everyone, to our latest podcast. Today, I am very happy to have with us Will Bowen, who is an intellectual property attorney based in Pasadena, California, who represents clients and small businesses and even large businesses all over California and has some federal law knowledge as well. And we're going to see, just like immigration, copyright, trademarks, all that stuff tends to blend into the federal arena as well. And before I introduce Will, we're going to give you a general overview of what this call is going to entail. First is going to be some general information so you know what the heck we're talking about, what the difference is between copyright, patents, intellectual property. And then we're going to talk, you know, when things get dramatic in your life, when you're entering into a marriage and you've got this great idea and how to protect if something goes wrong later in the marriage, how to protect your idea. And if the marriage doesn't work out, going through a divorce, what your options are from an intellectual property standpoint. And then if you just want to start a business in between the marriage, during the marriage, or when you have escaped a bad marriage, what your options are from an intellectual property standpoint. So with that, I want to introduce our speaker today, William Bowen. He goes by Will, who specializes solely in intellectual property litigation. Hopefully your case will never go that far, but he's going to give you some good preventive tips and some information on the basic law, so hopefully you can stay out of court. But Will has a very strong background in computer science and internet technology, which I know is of interest to a lot of our clients. We have a lot of people from San Jose and the Silicon Valley and people who are in the intellectual property fields of computer technology and are bringing their own ideas to a business or is thinking about starting their own business when Google doesn't pay enough. Mm-hmm. So Will's going to talk to us a bit about that. He's also the current co-chair of the technology section of the Pasadena Bar Association, so he'll know what you're talking about when you call him for a consultation, which is great. You don't have an attorney who's never used Skype before or doesn't know any of the lingo from your industry. So with that being said, Will, is there anything else I left out from your bio that you'd like to share with everyone?
No, I think that's great. I'm glad to hear that there's a lot of entrepreneurs among you working in Silicon Valley. I actually hail from Silicon Valley for my undergraduate education, so I have quite a few friends coming out of Stanford with me that have done work in startups themselves, including some of my friends who are originally from other countries and are here on visas. So I know that they probably share a lot of similar experiences that you do. And, you know, I'm excited to give information, help any way I can to enable people to build their businesses.
Great. Now, there's one thing I did leave out of your bio, which I think is very unique also among attorneys, is you speak a lot of languages.
Yes, I do. I learned French in high school. And then was overseas for 2 years living in Italy. So I speak French and Italian and spent my summer in Spain. So after very close to Italian. And then I also speak Mandarin Chinese, which I learned during my law school education. I actually also spent a summer over in China doing legal work there. So I love languages and I love travel and I love foreign culture and I think it's you know, it's useful because it's technology itself is a language and it enables you to, I think, understand things on a very abstract level, but you know, just enables you to, I think, work with a lot of different people and get a really great diversity of experience.
I'm amazed. I took French and Spanish in high school, and I got them all confused.
No, that's true. One of the I get that too. I still the Latin languages are all so close that people still will look at me when I speak French in particular and be very confused because I look like an American. I have an Italian accent from my time in Italy since that's my strongest language, and they just don't know quite where to place me.
Wow, that's great. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump into the content. Let's do some general information on what you do and generally the difference between what is a copyright, what's a patent, what does intellectual property entail, is there a difference between a product versus an idea? You want to jump into that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the first thing always to emphasize in intellectual property is that it is about ideas, and especially in the modern economy here in the United States, where a lot of the time, some of the physical labor is done and manufacturing is done elsewhere. We do still have a lot here in the United States, but a lot of it's overseas. Intellectual property and your ideas are sometimes one of the most important assets you can have in a business. And if somebody else takes the work that you've done to come up with an invention or an artistic creation, it can really be damaging. A lot of times, that's what you've spent hours and hours doing. So, intellectual property is all about protecting people's ideas, the work they've done that you can't put your hands on physically, but that resides in your mind or on a notebook or somewhere on your computer, and has to do with abstract thoughts. Intellectual property does not protect what I would call pure ideas. So, nobody can patent, the equations that that govern the laws of physics, or claim copyright to jazz music, generally speaking. It has to be something that is specific, and it has to fit into one of these. What I call, idea boxes or intellectual property boxes. And there's really four of them that the law covers. The first is for inventions. So these are useful things, and that's covered by patents. So you can get a patent if you've come up with a useful process or a useful article of manufacture. And this, generally will look something like you come up with this process or this invention, and you describe it on an abstract level. You develop a series of what are called patent claims, almost always with the help of an attorney, and you file it with the government. And then if somebody tries to do the same thing or something that fits that description of what you've invented, what you've come up with, then they're liable for patent infringement. So, patent protection protects your inventions. And in exchange for getting that protection, what you do is you make it public information what you've come up with so that after your patent term expires, other people can use it. So that's patent. And copyright, I guess, is on the other end, whereas patent is about a useful article. It's about a piece of technology. It's about a tool. So that's where you have the work for your engineers. That's the left-brained side of intellectual property. Then you have the right brain side of intellectual property, which is your copyrights. And copyrights are generally used to protect things that are creative, but not in the sense of developing a tool or solving a problem, but that are artistic. So copyrights protect original works of expression. And essentially this can be any work that you create, whether it be in words, whether it be in song, whether it be a sculpture, whether it be a dance, that is what it said is fixed in a tangible medium of expression. Now, that's a lot of jargon there. So let me clarify. Basically, you are protected with your copyrights as soon as you write something down or make a recording of it. And once you've made that recording, once you've written it down, people are protected. You're protected from people copying your creation. Now, they in copyright, they can still, the same way as patent, the pure idea is not necessarily protected. If you use a character that's a bear that lives in the woods, other people can write books about a bear that lives in the woods, but they can't use your specific character. They can't use what you've expressed. So copyright protects expression. The third form of intellectual property is a trademark. And a trademark protects more or less your good name for your business. And so a trademark is always associated with particular goods or services. In fact, when it's associated with services, it's called a service mark. When it's associated with a product, then it's called a trademark. And a trademark is developed when people associate a particular product or a particular service with a name or with a logo or with a tagline. So, of course, the classic example of this is Coca-Cola. People associate the name Coca-Cola with a particular soft drink that they buy that comes in cans that say Coca-Cola and it tastes a particular way. And it's Coca-Cola's way of identifying, this is mine, this is our soda pop. And if somebody else comes along and says, well, we're Coca-Cola too, and puts it in a can that bears the same name, that's going to be trademark infringement, because essentially what they're doing is deceiving consumers into believing that it was produced by the Coca-Cola company when in fact it was produced by someone else. So this is also important because one of the assets that you develop as a business is the more and more people work with you, whether it be a product, whether it be a good, a physical good, or a service, the more they're going to look at your reputation. Other people are going to say, hey, I worked with XYZ company and they were fantastic. And if somebody else comes along and decides that they're going to put XYZ company all over their t-shirts or all over their computer software and use your logo, then essentially they get to take advantage of all the work you've done to build your reputation as a business. And furthermore, it's dangerous because these may be people who don't produce a very good product, who have not invested the same amount of effort into quality that you have in your own business. So that's the reason for trademark law. And the last one is trade secret law. And trade secrets are often used when you can't fit a piece of intellectual property into one of the other three boxes. Particularly, there's a distinction between trade secrets and patents, because when you get a patent, as I mentioned earlier, you're telling the whole world what you've invented. And there are some things that that really aren't anything, novel or creative that you've come up with that isn't an invention per se, but they're things that you don't necessarily want your competition to have access to. A classic example is you've developed a list of customers. Well, there's nothing you've invented. There's these are people, their names and addresses that exist out somewhere in the world. You can't claim them for yourself against other people, but you have done the work to go compile your customer list, and it's not fair for somebody else to just take it and use it if it's something that you keep confidential. Now, if you put it out in the marketplace, they can do whatever they want with it. So trade secrets law protects you from having data that you keep private and confidential, marketing data, And it can be technical data. It can be, you know, a secret recipe, something that really wouldn't belong in a patent because it wouldn't take an inventor a great deal of effort to figure out or require an earth-shattering innovation. But it's something that's worked for you that you don't necessarily want other people to be able to copy with no consequences. So those kind of things you can protect through trade secrets law, and there's various steps you can take to keep things secret. You can have your employees sign non-disclosure agreements. You can keep certain files under lock and key. And all those things are important to make a claim of trade secrets, because one of the things you have to do in order to claim trade secrets is you're not allowed to claim something as a trade secret if you haven't done something to make it seem like a secret or to keep it secret from other people. It does have to be secret, can't be public. So, long answer to a very simple question.
Well,
but those are kind of the intellectual property boxes and the things that you can protect with IP.
Well, and I like how you've broken it down for us, but, you know, I'm looking at everything, taking notes myself, and I'm like, well, you know, take Coca-Cola, for instance. It seems like they could have a patent, they could have a trademark, they could have trade secrets.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. That's an excellent point, and it's an important one to remember. In the ordinary business, you're probably going to need all of these things. Yeah, you know, there are some businesses that are oriented towards technology that may not need patent protection, but for the most part, these things are all going to be involved in any business, and particularly when you're talking again about high tech or Silicon Valley. The example I will give of that is that I always present to people is the iPhone. So, you know, if you hold up an iPhone to someone, it's got an enormous amount of intellectual property in the space of that phone. I mean, it's got a lot of software and a lot of hardware, but there's also a lot of law that you hold in your phone when it's in your hand. And one of the most famous intellectual property cases, of course, has to do with patent law, Apple v. Samsung. And that was actually over a form of patent protection, which is, you know, I talked about patents as an invention, but there's actually two kinds of patents. There's a utility patent, which covers, you know, technical aspects of how something works. And then there's a design patent, which can cover its aesthetics. And Apple basically had a design patent on the rounded corners of the phone, won millions of dollars based on that design. So there's a design patent. There's also going to be utility patents. On the software in the phone, there's going to be algorithms for the computer software that are proprietary, that are protected by patents that other people can't use. There's going to be patents on the hardware in the phone that's based on the physics and the mechanics, perhaps, of how the touch screen works or how the volume control works. There's going to be copyrights on all of the software. Software is copyrightable. You write source code, and your source code can be copyrighted. Other people can't just cut and paste your source code to create their own software without violating your copyright. And of course, all of the visuals, all of your applications, all of those graphics, those are forms of expression. Those are subject to copyright. And then lastly, which is perhaps the most obvious one, the Apple that's on the back of your phone, that's Apple's trademark. People aren't allowed to make other phones in the United States that have Apples on them if they don't come from Apple, if they're not actually Apple computers. Although, interesting story about that and the importance of intellectual property rights. One of the mistakes Apple made with its intellectual property is that they actually failed to trademark the iPhone in China, which is always something that you want to think about, that the intellectual property is now international. So Somebody else rushed into the fray, decided to get a trademark for iPhone in China. So their people can now have produce iPhones in China that aren't associated with Apple. And that's something that they just have to cope with. The iPhone there is not always an Apple phone. So always important in any business to think about your intellectual property rights ahead of time, even on a global level, if that's planning, if that's where you're planning to go.
Well, that can seem pretty overwhelming. I mean, there's hundreds of countries in the world. How would you know? I mean, you just take a shot in the dark as to the ones that are most likely to rip off your product?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult business calculation, and that's definitely something, you know, while our primary role as intellectual property lawyers is, of course, to help you do the nitty-gritty to get your rights protected legally, we also work a lot with businesses, and we help advise people on what it's good to do as a business matter to protect your intellectual property and how that interfaces with the law. And it definitely depends on your business plan. Some people want to build a business just in California. That's really the only place they're interested in going. And some people really have plans to have a global business. And usually people are interested in intellectual property protection in, you know, the largest market. So the United States is usually the largest and most important market. But then people often have an interest in having a patent in the European Union or a trademark in the European Union, which is good because cover all of Europe. And China is another market a lot of times where people want to get patent protection these days. There are others. Japan is often a market that people also want to get patent protection in. The good news is that there's a lot of international treaties at this point that can help you if you get intellectual property in one country. There's some certain kind of automatic privileges that you're able to have in trying to protect it in other countries. So if you get a patent in the United States, if you file within a certain amount of time in other countries, you're going to get the same priority date in terms of when your patent is effective, of when the invention is said to be made, based on when you filed in the United States. So that's one thing that allows you to do. And there's similar rights for trademarks. You file and you register a trademark in the United States. You have a certain period of time where it's very easy to get a trademark in certain other countries.
So I have a general question about patents. Why would anyone invent something and knowing that the term is going to expire and become public and they'll no longer get proceeds from it?
Well, the first reason is that the patent term is actually quite long. It's 21 years for utility patents. So it's a little shorter for design patents, but it's still long enough that really and truly, I think this is something that the people in internet technology and high tech can appreciate. But by the time 21 years have gone by, you've already earned a lot of money on your invention, and probably that what you invented, there's a good possibility that it might be entirely obsolete. I don't know if people are still making money off the patents that went into the hardware for 5 1/4 inch floppy disks, but I would
good
surprised.
Point. Or the beeper, yeah.
Or cell phone pagers, those car phones that look like a brick. It's unlikely. Perhaps there's some copyright protection now that for those being sold as vintage vintage items or as part of art exhibits. But as far as the actual useful element of the technology goes, most of your revenue stream is going to come in the first few years of the technology anyway. And after the patent term expires, there's a good chance that you will have moved on anyway. Interestingly, you know, that's true of patent, but it's even true of copyright to some extent. Some of the argument that people have made for relaxing copyright rules or making things more open in terms of copyright terms is they say, you know, usually a new movie comes out, a new song comes out, where do you get most of the revenue? It's a hit on the radio for a year or two usually, but after a while people kind of forget about it for the most part. Now there's always an exception. There are classic songs that never really go away, that continue to provide an incredible revenue stream long, long after they've been published, even sometimes after the person who made them has died. But usually most of your profit comes right at the beginning.
But that would be a copyright though, right?
Yeah, for a song, that'd be a copyright.
Okay. Okay, because that brings up another area. I mean, we're both in Southern California, less than an hour away from, you know, the entertainment capital of the world. So we see screenwriters, authors, songwriters, you know, and many different types of artists. So majority of their contracts will involve copyright law as opposed to patent or trademark, right?
Yeah, people that are doing almost anything artistic, it's going to be more copyright than patent or trademarks. I mean, I think anybody can really use, but it's definitely going to be more of a copyright than a patent issue. Because while artists rely on technology, obviously, if you're a songwriter or a recording artist, you have to use recording technology. It's not something that you're focused on inventing or making. What your creation is really the notes, the ideas, the expression that comes through artistic work. And those people are in particular need of copyright protection. And again, you know, almost any business, of course, that's an interesting thing. Almost any business is in need of copyright protection. It's one thing a lot of times people don't understand. I mean, the classic example and where copyright, I think, is most important is really for people in these artistic endeavors. But copyright, for something to be copyrightable, it doesn't have to be what I would call high art. The photos you take of your products that you put on your websites, you know, you may not be able to sell those to the Museum of Modern Art. I don't know. You may, maybe you're very clever in the way you do your lighting, and it's an extra revenue stream for you. But most likely it's something that you're using to market. It's not something that you're trying to use as art in and of itself. That doesn't matter. It's still a form of expression, and it's still something you can have copyright protection in. And certainly there are other things that you're going to invest a fair amount of time and money in that are expressive in nature. The way your website is designed, some of the writing that you do, perhaps you do articles about your products, or you do articles about advice in your field for your customers. Those things are copyrightable. They do take work, they do take effort, and you don't want somebody else to be able to take those and use those without any compensation when you've put a lot of time and effort into doing that work and into coming up with those ideas. So that copyright protection is useful, I think almost for any business.
So the typical question I see is, well, you know, I'm just starting off in my career, I'm just opening my business, how much is this going to cost to make sure that my ideas are protected because I'm not a millionaire yet?
Right. Yeah, and I think that's always a really important consideration. You know, it's something that you definitely want to consider. My advice would always be that one of the things I would do, I would speak with somebody, either a business consultant that deals with intellectual property or an intellectual property attorney, to find out and figure out, get some advice from them on what it's going to cost versus what the potential return is. Actually, one of the interesting things is that a lot of intellectual property protection is much cheaper and easier than people think it is. The best example of that is copyright protection. So you can register a copyright. It costs you less than $50 in government fees to register a copyright. It's a fairly quick and easy process, and it can be done online. Now, it is something that I recommend when you register a copyright for the very first time that you work with an attorney to do it, because if you get in the habit of doing your copyrights wrong and then you come up in a situation where you're in a lawsuit, it puts you in a very bad spot, because the other side is going to either say your copyrights aren't valid because you made some mistakes on the form, or even worse, they're going to accuse you of lying to the government.
Uh-oh. Never good.
Yeah, and I have seen this happen. And most of the time, it's just people that didn't really understand what the form meant and how to fill it out, because it was in legalese. But at the point that you've done it once with an attorney, and they've kind of walked you through, then you can either do it yourself or delegate it to an employee to get your copyrights registered, and it can be much more affordable. But I always recommend that for the first time going through that process, a client come and do it together with an attorney just to see how it's done, so that they know it can be done the right way. And trademarks are similarly affordable. The government fees are a little bit higher. Trademarks are a few hundred dollars, a little bit more than a few hundred dollars, just for the government fees, without attorney's fees. However, again, registering a trademark, you're protecting your good name, which is really worth a lot. And particularly if you do think you have a name that's clever, that's going to attract attention, that's going to bring people to you, well, you want to get that name before somebody else rushes in, because if somebody else rushes in and registers a mark, or starts using their products with that mark, not only can it be the case that you won't be able to stop them from doing it, but potentially it can stop you if they claim priority from using that name or using that mark. So also an area where it's worth it. And usually with trademarks, there's not a whole lot you have to do in terms of a repeat process. You'll want the name of your business as a word mark. So you can trademark words, you can trademark designs, and then you'll probably want your logo. And as time goes on and things get more complicated, perhaps you'll want your tagline and whatnot. But at least to start out just with getting your name protected, it is reasonably affordable. Patent protection is more expensive. It is a long process, and it's also, you know, not only are the government fees substantial, and can be a few thousand dollars, but the attorney's fees can be substantial as well, because it takes a lot of time to go back and forth with the government. They have to look and see, you know, there are people that specialize in the technology area where you're patenting something that have to really study the technology and look and see whether what you came up with is truly inventive or not. And there's a back and forth with that process. So that can be considerably more expensive. And on that front, there may be good justification for you waiting if you don't have a lot of startup funds before getting a patent. That said, there are cheaper options. You can do a provisional patent, which is considerably cheaper. When it comes to patents, you know, any of these services, there's always people who and services that will suggest doing them on your own for low cost, particularly when it comes to patent. I do not suggest that. Filing a patent on your own will be an extremely confusing process, and the likelihood that you'll end up with a patent that's not worth the paper it's written on is very, very high if it's an attorney that has not done it, because people just, you know, people make a lot of mistakes. Engineers always want, of course, to describe their technology in great detail, and if you do that in a certain way in a patent, if you do that in your patent claims, then only a very, very specific invention that's exactly like yours is going to be protected, and somebody's going to make a very small change and be off the hook. So you really do want to work with an attorney on that who understands the law of technology as well as the technology itself.
That makes sense. Now, there could even be problems with, let's say, someone who is a screenwriter, right, who has one edition that they submit. What happens if they have a copyright on that script and then, you know, it gets back to their agent? Their agent says, okay, this studio really likes this, but they want you to change this aspect of it. So now your original product is changing. Do you have to have another copyright? Do you have to amend it? What do you do?
Well, so you don't have to re-register the copyright, although you certainly can register multiple versions of something. There's nothing wrong with that. One of the interesting things about copyright that many people don't realize is that it's actually the case you have copyright in something as soon as you write it down, as soon as you record it. You actually have rights even without doing anything with the government. There is a right as soon as something, again, is in a fixed medium, so that there's some record of it. And now there are certain advantages to registering your copyrights. One of those, if you ever do want to bring a lawsuit, you can't bring a lawsuit until it's registered. And when you do bring a lawsuit, if you haven't registered it fairly quickly after it's published, then it becomes very difficult to get your money's worth out of a lawsuit, because at that point you can only get what somebody else earned from copying or what you lost from somebody else copying. And that's, it may be a lot of money, but that can be very difficult to argue and very difficult to prove.
Yeah, it seems like a proof problem. It's your word against the other person's.
It's your word against the other person, and yeah. they're gonna, and it's gonna be hours of attorney time going over people's business records, saying, "Hey, you earned this month versus the next month, and how much of that is because you copied this product versus how much of it is because of your other products you sell," and just that analysis, that back and forth, sometimes makes it not worth your while. Whereas if you register your copyrights promptly, you can have what are called statutory damages, and that can be up to $150,000 for every copyright that somebody else has infringed. So it's much more substantial, and that's largely up to the discretion of a judge or a jury.
So it's worth the $50 if you can get that much in the end.
it is worth the $50. It definitely is. And, you know, as to your question, do you register the different versions? When you have a copyright in a work, one of the rights that you have is you have the right to derivative works. So basically, things that come from your work that are transformations of the work that you've done, and that would I believe include multiple versions. Those are all things that you own apart from the actual work itself. So there really wouldn't be a need to re-register. Now, it is something to be aware of when you deal with signing your rights with a studio or with a production company. One of the questions that you'll want to look at when you look at that contract is who has the right to derivative work. So, I mean, sometimes that's left with the copyright owner, and sometimes the studios want that for themselves. So they want the right to produce your work, and but they want to be able to produce any of the sequels to it, or or merchandise that goes with it. So that's a catchphrase that you'll want to look for when you look through your contract when you're negotiating over those rights.
So this is a sort of cloudy area. Let's say you have an actress who's up and coming, and you know a film puts her on the map. Can she, I guess, trademark her name so no product can associate her as the sponsor or celebrity associated with that product?
It certainly is possible to trademark a name. Of course, one of the things that's often a misconception that people think is, if I do have my name, I can automatically sell products under it. And unfortunately, if somebody else has already trademarked your name and you have the same name, well, that's unfortunate for you that you have a common name that somebody else already beat you to a trademark for. But yes, you certainly can trademark your name along with a product, and it's something that you will want to do. Keeping in mind that I think the challenge always when you're looking at a trademark is there has to be, as I said, products, goods or services that are associated with that mark or associated with your name. So, for instance,
John Grisham, he could trademark his name because he's got all these books.
He could, he could associate with those books, but it's more like, you know, it's a particular kind of thing. I mean, I suppose the question would be at that point whether trademark would provide you the most advantage as an author, because if somebody else puts a book out there with your name on it, you don't just have a claim in trademark. I mean, that would probably be a claim in fraud if somebody else
copyright
listed
right? Okay.
themselves
okay.
as an author of a book that they didn't in fact author.
Right.
trying to portray themselves as you. But I think entertainers and actors a lot of times do want to have products that are associated with them. I mean, you know, the classic one is always with celebrities. At some point, they start a fragrance, right?
Mm-hmm. And too many out there right now.
Yeah, there's many out there, many celebrity fragrances. And those are ones that, you want your name associated with a particular scent. And your name is going to be the trademark for that particular fragrance or for that particular perfume. And and I think it's a good idea. And I have several friends to think about whether you want to do some product merchandising. I mean, that can be a double bonus. It can be a way to make money in the entertainment industry if you sell some T-shirts or other products together with your play or your comedy set or whatever you're doing. But it can also be an effective marketing tool at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so you benefit by getting better marketing, you benefit by making some money, and your name is getting out there. And that's really what trademark is all about. Trademark is about marketing and getting your name out there. And so I think there's an advantage to thinking at the beginning of your career when you're an artist, what is my trademark? What do I want to be the thing that people remember me by? People remember the work I do. And then once you get that name going, once it's been associated with a particular product or good or service, you can also expand it to other areas and expand what you use it for.
Okay. Wow. That was a very thorough and enlightening discussion. I know it can get very confusing, so I appreciate that. Let's go into the issues that arise when you're entering into a marriage and you are either about to join a company or copyright a I don't know book you've written. How do you protect yourself going into the marriage to make sure that you keep a hold of that as your sole ownership, or that, you know, if the marriage goes bad later, that you're not on the hook to, you know, for splitting your royalties with your ex-wife the rest of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's is a good question, and it's something to think about. And one of the interesting things that I think with intellectual property is that it becomes extra important, because if it's done the right way, you don't give some thought to this, it may be the case not only that that you have to split the proceeds from your intellectual property, but the intellectual property may lose its value entirely. Because you have two people trying to control something that you really can't divide. It's one of those things, you know, that if it comes to a divorce, it's a little bit like child custody. It's not as easy to you can't exactly split it in half and give each person half of it. Mm-hmm. How do you split an idea down the middle? Mm-hmm. You can split the money from it down the middle, but the idea itself, it becomes very difficult, and if you try to do that, your idea may become worthless for both people. So it's something that's definitely important to think about. I think that, you know, in California at least, and these things vary from state to state. When you go into a marriage, what you own is your separate property, but it becomes complicated. You know, what if you're working on a business, you're working on a book, you haven't fully completed it, and then some of it happens during the course of a marriage. So one of the things you can do, to the extent that you have or decide to enter into a prenuptial agreement, this can be something that you can think about, is you can assign the rights to a project that you're working on to yourself or to your spouse. I mean, I realize, of course, that there are many people who don't want to go into a marriage and deal with a prenuptial agreement. I think that at that point, the best thing you can do is claim the rights you have before you go into the marriage, before you go in. So if you're writing a book, register your copyright. If it's an asset that has to do with a business that you're involved in, I think the best practice is almost always, whether you're currently in the marriage, whether it's before marriage, to assign the rights to your intellectual property to the business. You know, if you have a patent or you have an invention, assign it to the business. If you have a copyright, have an attorney assigned to the business. A trademark has to be in some sense associated with a business, because again, it's associated with a good or a service. And so, you know, if you have a business and there's a dissolution of a marriage or whatnot, and both people have the right to a trademark, well, you know, that can be a disaster, because there can be two different businesses that are out there trying to use the same mark, competing with customers totally confused as to who is who. Not really good for anyone at the end of the day. So I think when it comes to a business asset, whether it be a copyright, trademark, or a patent, the best practice is usually to have a business that is itself incorporated. And that's one of the advantages of incorporating a business in general, is that when you have an informally organized business, you're just working with, and it can be your spouse or it can be a friend or whatnot, there are personal issues. Well, if you haven't thought about it ahead of time, how that business is going to continue to run if people don't get along, or if someone wants out, then you're in a situation that's really a mess, where you've got people squabbling over who gets what, and chances are that everybody's going to lose, and the business will go under, and nobody will carry it on. That's never what you want with a business. on the other hand, when you incorporate something or form a limited liability company, one of the things that an attorney will help you with is they will make provisions for what happens if somebody leaves the company. And similarly, when you've got a business, if there is a divorce or a dissolution of a marriage, then the spouse may have, they may have some rights to the proceeds or the income from the business, but they're not necessarily going to have right to control the business. They can't shut the business down and insist on trying to control it, which will allow the business to continue to operate effectively and at least, you know, at least produce products. So I think that the best practice almost always with intellectual property is be clear about it and do anything you can to clarify your rights before you go in to a marriage. And to the extent you can, when your intellectual property rights are involved in a business, incorporate the business and assign the rights to the business, because then even if personal relationships don't work out, the business is its own entity that can go on despite any disagreements between people that are involved in the business or between spouses of people that are involved in the business.
Now, there's a couple of things you mentioned. One of them was like the royalties or, you know, the profit from the actual idea, since it's very hard to split an idea. Even if a business is incorporated and you have, let's say, the husband and the wife who are joint owners of that corporation, right, mm-hmm. the only officers there, I mean, how do you draw a line between how much of the proceeds from the business come from that original idea versus the operations of the business?
Right. I mean, that becomes very, very difficult. And I think, you know, that is one that that is challenging. I will say that any kind of situation where a business splits up or where there's a division, you know, a family division, people get divorced, it gets very messy, and you can, one of the ways to handle that would be to think about that before you go into a marriage. Hey, if this doesn't work, I'll keep the business and you keep, you know, I don't know, the house.
Yeah.
There may be some wisdom in taking that approach if you are open to doing a prenuptial agreement. As to what happens after, that's where family law attorneys get into the mix, and they're going to hire experts, and it can be very costly, but essentially what will happen is you'll have one expert in that that says, oh, well, you know, again, because business is something that's not easily divisible, it's likely that it's going to have to go to one person or another. And then one side's going to say, oh, there's an enormous amount of proceeds for business. It's worth a lot of money. And so there's an expectation that this much, you know, the spouse that's not getting the business will get a lot of money on their side. And the other person is going to say, you know, this business isn't really profitable. It doesn't make any money. So the other person shouldn't really get very much in exchange for having this person continue with the business. And the experts will testify, and, you know, the judge will basically look at who they believe. And the experts in that field are good at doing valuation of businesses. There's also a lot of experts that do valuation of intellectual property specifically. So it's actually a field with experts that have advanced degrees and do this for a living. They look at what they think a value of a patent or a copyright is and determine how much it's worth. And that it's very common because it's something that has to be done when one business is acquired for another, by another, for example. A lot of times, intellectual property evaluators will come in and or valuation experts will come in and look at the value of intellectual property, because people who are purchasing want to know how much it's worth. And frankly, a lot of times with businesses, again, these days, intellectual property can be where a large portion of the assets are. And similar things will happen in bankruptcy court. If a business does go bankrupt, people will come and look at how valuable intellectual property is. There can be similar tax issues. And sometimes one of the things that you want to do as a business is you'll want to look at the value of your intellectual property, because you'll want to determine whether it's something you do want to sell or give away. And perhaps your business goes in a different direction than you originally thought, and a piece of technology that you used at the beginning is not terribly useful, but it's something that's clever. It's something you've invested money on getting a patent on, and you think it's useful to either assign or license it to someone else. Well, you can bring in a valuation expert that can say, this is how much we think the patent is worth. This is the revenue stream that we think that that you can get from it.
Now, can you technically assign any four of these types of intellectual property?
Yes. Well, you can. I wouldn't say any. I mean, you can assign it. You can definitely assign copyrights. You can assign trademarks, but there's a caveat that I'll talk about in a minute. You can definitely assign patents. Trade secrets are difficult to formally assign.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the issue with a trade secret is mostly that it's a matter of,
yeah, that makes
passing
sense.
On a secret, right?
Right. Get you criminally charged, yeah.
Unlike these other forms of intellectual property, there's not anything filed with the government or even kept internally that defines exactly what the secret is. I think that's a matter of saying, hey, you know, if somebody else is acquiring your business, you can say, I'll give you this piece of information, or, you know, this is part of the value of what I'm giving you, but there's not really any formal mechanism that I know of.
Before we go further, can you explain what you mean by assign?
Assign. Okay, so yes, this is lawyerly jargon. when you assign something, basically you're taking this abstract creature. It's a right, and you're telling somebody else. You're saying, this is now yours. This thing, and basically you can do anything that I could have done with it. So if it's a patent, what could I have done with that patent? Well, I could offer to let somebody else use the idea for money, but I still keep control of whether I'm going to let them do it or not. That's called a license, which is another piece of jargon that's important. So you license something, you'll give somebody permission for something, and you can sell permission to use your ideas. Or if I have a patent, I can sue somebody else who is using a piece of technology that infringes my patent. So I have the right to sue them. Well, when I assign that patent, I'm transferring that whole bundle of everything I can do with it over to somebody else and saying, hey, you know, I'm done with this. At that point, I no longer have – there's nothing I can do with that idea in the court system. I can't sue anybody. I can't tell anybody else whether or not they have a right to use it. I've given that whole, you know, that whole bundle of power, that bundle of rights to somebody else. And then it's up to them, and they can do what they please with it. When it's been assigned, they can – give other people permission to use the idea. They can license it. They can bring them into court. If somebody else is using it without their permission, they can sue. Or they can take that bundle of rights and they can pass it on to somebody else, and they can sell it and say, here, I'm assigning it now to you, and this is yours, and I just like some money, and you figure out what to do with it and what it's worth, and if there's anybody you want to sue or there's anybody you want to give permission to in exchange for some compensation.
Now, this can create a mess, though, right? If you try to assign, say, a copyright during a marriage, if the copyright was either in both names or it was never officially registered, right?
Right. It could be a mess. I mean, one of the things too that's always complicated to think about even when you're involved in some of these intellectual property rights themselves can be jointly owned from the beginning. You co-write a book together with your spouse. There's joint copyright in that, and if you register it with the government, you'll have to file one that has joint authorship, and you have to specify what each person did, and that can be quite messy. But I agree with the general principle: the less you document who did what, who owns what, and the longer you wait to get those things done and to go through those formalities, the messier it gets. And for a couple of reasons. One is always the possibility of bad blood, and people are angry and people say, I wrote the whole book. I did everything in the business, and they'll claim more than they really have. But the other is, frankly, that I think most people, even in the heat of and rancor of those situations, are basically honest. But people's emotions get heated, and it's very easy to exaggerate, and it's very easy for both parties to remember their contribution as more than it really was. And then you're spending time in the court system fighting out exactly who did what, with both people claiming that what was accomplished, what was put together, was actually really theirs. And when there's no records to look back on to see who has the more accurate memory, then it's just people screaming at each other. Mm. And the court system essentially has to make an educated guess, but it's much messier than if there's records, and if that's neat and it's clean and it's clear from the beginning what went on.
Yeah, and one of the central theme we keep hitting home here is, you need to preventively take measures before you get into a marriage. You know, even though everything seems mm-hmm. wonderful now and you're so in love with this person, you trust them, if your invention is that important to you or this idea, you need to just, have this registered before you get into the marriage so it's clear if something does go wrong, but also that it's really not expensive to do this. But mm-hmm. I think one of the questions that would arise out of this is, well, if I'm going to go see a family lawyer for a prenup to cover this, why can't the family lawyer just cover this provision inside the prenup? Is there a reason why I should also consult an IP attorney?
Well, I think that's a great question. And one of the things that you can do, of course, is that, attorneys like us tend to enjoy collaborating, and it's actually, I think, to the advantage of everybody. It's to the advantage of a client, because one of the reasons that attorneys specialize is that even though I know something about family law, I've had to pass the bar. If somebody asks me a question about family law, it's going to take me a long time to figure out the answer, and that's going to cost a lot of money if I decide to go research it myself and read a whole bunch of books on family law that a family law attorney has already read over the course of her 5-year career. It's going to be more time intensive for me, it's going to be more expensive, and frankly, it's more likely that I'm going to get the wrong answer. So even looking at this is, how can I save my client money and get the right answer? Well, for me as an attorney, one of the things that I would do if I have one of those questions, with my client's permission, of course, is say, you know, can I pick up the phone and call my friend who does family law and ask her this question, because she's been doing this for years, has a lot of experience, and will know much better than I will, and it's going to actually save time, which is going to save you money. And that's almost always the most effective way to do things. So I think it's always to your advantage to have a relationship with several attorneys and say, hey, you know, can you communicate and collaborate on this? Because it's an issue that goes across different specialties and different lines.
Yeah, I know from my own experience with so many of my clients getting in and out of bad marriages, we deal with family lawyers a lot. And family lawyers, just like you're saying, they have a particular specialty. But they don't keep up on intellectual property law and patents and how the law changes or the recent case. They keep up with family law. So, yeah, maybe they could do a general provision in your prenup. But if you ever get sued, if this, you know, creates a multi-million dollar, you know, company from the product that you've invented, and a family lawyer has put this provision in here that may not hold up in litigation later in an intellectual property lawsuit, right? So really, if you have something that you think, you know, is really inventive or something that you think could make you a lot of money in the long term, it's worth having that consultation and getting the input of an IP lawyer if you're going to have the family lawyer draft this as part of a general prenup.
Absolutely, it absolutely is, and that's, you know, that's one of the reasons, because again, you know, family law is generally a matter of state law. So family attorneys are in state court. Intellectual property is federal law. It's a whole different area of law. If there's some dispute over a piece of intellectual property and it's connected to family law, it's not even clear who you go to resolve that in all cases. If it's an issue of who of ownership of intellectual property, that can be a state law issue. But if it's an issue of who actually invented something, who's the person that whose name should have been on the patent in the first place, well, then you're in federal court. And this is something where it's valuable to have input from both people. And again, the principle is, I think when you're talking about being proactive and doing these things ahead of time, one of the concerns people have is the expense of legal services. But I actually, most of my work, even though I do file some trademarks and copyrights for people and help them to get patents put together, that may seem expensive, but most of what I do is litigation. And if people think that it's expensive to address these things up front, well, I'm here to tell you it's much, much, much more expensive to fight over them later. And whereas, you know, I have clients that may be unhappy with the idea of spending money up front to protect their intellectual property, I can promise you that the most unhappy people are those who are in the middle of a court battle fighting over things and spending a lot of money because these issues weren't addressed up front. It's always the wiser course, and you will save yourself trouble and headache and heartache thinking about things up front, whether that be with a family law attorney in terms of prenuptial agreement, whether that be getting your intellectual property rights in order at the beginning of your business rather than at the moment somebody tries to rip you off and all of a sudden you have to scramble to protect the work you've done, whether that be incorporating your business itself so that when your business is running and somebody gets upset with you, you have somebody bring a lawsuit against you. You don't have all of your personal assets at stake in a lawsuit. So the money spent up front for legal services, I think, is almost always well worth it.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I have a feeling that we're going to have some people outside of California calling you for some advice. Now, I know it gets a little weird and cloudy because intellectual property has both federal law and state law implications. So, A, where are your clients located? And B, would you take calls from outside of California?
Yeah, our clients are located all over the country. So we do work on behalf of people in many different states and locations. And one of the good things about intellectual property law is that it is mostly federal. It's at least, you know, it's about 90%.
Just like immigration. Great.
Federal law, right? Yeah, I mean, there's a few small issues. The places where state law enters in intellectual property law, trade secrets law is a matter of state law. And so that'll vary a little bit from state to state. There is a Uniform Trade Secrets Act, so it's generally very similar from one state to another, but it's not always exactly the same. And that is an issue where if you had to file a lawsuit, you'd need to do it in state court. And it may be easier if you have someone local. But the other three areas of law do have federal jurisdiction. Now you can have state trademark claims. Trademark law is a strange creature because it's both state and federal. So you can have both state and federal trademark rights at the same time. But usually most people want to address any trademark rights in the federal forum. There's a lot of advantages to that. And ownership of any of these rights can be a state law issue. So if you draft contracts that assign rights from one person to another or do licenses, those can be a matter of state law. But again, contract law from one jurisdiction to another is often very, very similar. I think that intellectual property law in California is a good place to practice intellectual property law. We know a lot about it because so much of our economy is based on it, with both Silicon Valley and Hollywood located here. So a lot of the case law that surrounds intellectual property law, a lot of the decisions about what these things mean have come down in California. So I think that we're particularly well qualified to opine on California law. But the other thing is, if there truly is an issue that comes up that is a matter of the law of a different state, first of all, in the internet age, it used to be that it's been, you know, very difficult to look things up because, you know, I might work in a law firm in California, and we may not have books with the law in it for all 50 states in our law library. Maybe we couldn't afford that back 30, 40 years ago. Today, these are all things that can be looked up online. Even if it's a matter of filing a lawsuit, it used to be that the only way to do that was to march down to the courtroom with papers in hand for whatever jurisdiction you're in and file a lawsuit. Now we are in an age of electronic filing where, honestly, most of what I do in terms of getting papers to a court is done from my computer online. So even if I have to litigate a case in New York or Texas or some other jurisdiction, most of that I can do without actually leaving my office. And to the extent that I need something to be done by hand, then there's always the possibility that I can contact somebody that I know that lives in that other place and have them do it and save the client money that way. And it's very common. Usually attorneys, even if they're litigating a case in a distant jurisdiction, they'll have what's called local counsel. They'll have a relationship with a law firm in that place that can do any of the legwork that has to be done over there.
But that's mostly litigation, right?
That's mostly
preventative stuff you can do.
all the preventative stuff is stuff that we can do. Mm-hmm. There's really not a lot of restrictions on writing up contracts or and especially there's not going to be issues with filing with the federal agencies, whether it be patent, trademark, or copyright, through the patent trademark office or the copyright office. Those are all things that we can do.
Great. So then the next question and last question is, how do people reach you?
You can reach us by phone. You can reach us by email. You can look at our website. Our website is www.usip, so United States Intellectual Property, .com. And my email is William, W-I-L-L-I-A-M, .Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, @ USIP.com. Our phone number here is 626-796-4000. And you're always welcome to come visit us. We are here in Pasadena. It's a lovely city.
if you just happen to be
in the area, we're on 100 Corson Street here in Pasadena. But my suspicion is, again, in the internet age, that that might not be the easiest way to contact us, but who knows? So those are our parameters. And if you have any questions about anything that was discussed today and just want some general advice on intellectual property law, please feel free to call us. And obviously, if you have any specific needs and you're looking into getting your trademarks, patents, copyrights in order, or figure out what to do with the ideas that you've developed or that you're considering acquiring even from someone else, please feel free to give me or give us a call.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much. This was jam-packed with tons of great, useful information, and we really got rid of the notion that, you know, to protect your ideas is not going to cost you a fortune up front, which is really important because it could cost you a fortune in litigation later if you don't.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you again for your time today, Will. We definitely appreciate it. And join us next time for the next Marriage and Immigration Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Marriage and Immigration Podcast. Subscribe to future podcasts through iTunes. If you have a question you would like to see answered on this podcast, email us at podcast@humanrightsattorney.com. Visit our website, humanrightsattorney.com, to obtain your free guide, How to Choose an Immigration Attorney. Access our videos, blog, and read success stories of clients who were able to overcome their complicated immigration problems with Heather's representation.